Mike, did you ever do a triathlon?
No.
Can you swim?
Actually, I used to swim for the town.
Exactly.
We're getting an insight into the way that this man's brain works. He opened his head and there's just one of those monkeys riding a unicycle.
Hi, my name's Ruth Astle and welcome to the Velocino podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Velocino podcast, where the best stories have not yet been written. This week we are joined by a bit of a legend and a supreme athlete in Ruth Astle. Not only is she ex-Zwift Academy, and anyone who's been on Zwift knows quite how hard that is to achieve, she's also currently the fastest non-pro triathlete woman in the world, which is pretty fast times from last year. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Ruth, I'm going to have to make a confession early on. I've never actually done a triathlon myself. But I know Niels has. So I'm sure he has got tons and tons of questions all about, I'm sure, whatever it is, transition and various other things.
You have no clue what you're talking about, right?
No. I think I've run out of my triathlon knowledge already. Absolutely.
Well, to be fair, I actually got into cycling via triathlon back then in South Africa when I met Hannah. She was in some kind of a triathlon club, and then obviously when I wanted to spend time with her, I also had to go cycling, swimming, and not so much running, because running is obviously not what I like. After that, I've done a couple of half Ironmans in Mallorca, and luckily I was always able to finish them without even practicing running, which was quite good.
That's quite impressive. I think for a lot of people the run, I don't think it's as hard as the swim for a lot of people, but the run is still, for most people, if they hadn't trained, they would probably struggle to finish a half Ironman. So I think you're quite lucky in that sense.
I just realized when you swim and then you hammer the bike, you can conveniently walk.
Well, I guess it depends what your aspirations are for finishing. But yeah, if you just want to finish, you can do that.
I just do it for the medal.
So Ruth, you've obviously famously came in, you know, you're part of the Zwift Academy. And for anyone who's followed you and looked at some of your YouTube videos, and by the way, they're really well produced, your YouTube videos, has seen some of the aero stuff you've done, some of the truly professional setup that you got with Zwift. And so what was it from that that made you think about going into the longest distance in terms of triathlon? Was it, you know, a bike specialist moving into triathlon, or was it a bit more of an all-rounder in the first place?
So, I mean, I got into triathlon back in 2013. I actually did one with work, a sort of charity one. They had a spare place, and I was actually training for the Berlin Marathon at the time, and I was pretty bored of running. And I'd started doing a little bit of cycling because my cousins were quite into cycling, so I'd done a little bit of cycling with them. Swimming has never really been my thing, but I'd done a little bit at school, so I was like, I can swim. So kind of thought, why not? Let's try it, give it a go, and just really enjoyed it. And then I joined my local tri club, and it kind of just spiraled from there. So when I first got into it, I was doing Olympic distance and a few duathlons, which were a bit better for me because my swim is my weakest. But yeah, I think within the first year of actually doing some of those races, I saw people that were then wearing their GB age group kit, and I was like, oh, I need to get involved with that. That looks really cool, you know, being able to race for your country. And I went out to Chicago for the championships in the Olympic distance and was kind of like, oh, this is really hard. Like, these girls, like, they were just so fast. They were running like 36 minute 10K, which where I was at the time just seemed nowhere near achievable. And I had at that point, I think like a couple of months before that, I did my first longer than Olympic distance triathlon at Alpe d'Huez, which is an amazing triathlon, especially if you like cycling. The bike course is epic. But kind of thought, actually, I've always been more of an endurance athlete than a speed athlete. So I then started moving up. So I did my first 70.3 the year after that, which must have been 2016, and then my first Ironman in 2017. So I think I always knew that endurance was more my thing than speed. So it was always kind of the plan to get there eventually. But yeah, I don't know, I think like now, you know, some people that just go straight into Ironman, so I feel like my progression was actually quite slow.
So actually, you mentioned about getting into it in 2013 and you'd done a bit of swimming at school. I was really interested, what kind of sports were you into as a kid? Because I think a lot of people talk about, you know, you don't typically do triathlon at school, for example. No. You sort of do something else that gets you into it. So what was it that you were particularly into at school? Were you, the sportiest kid? I imagine you were captain of every team.
No, I was very average. I played a lot of hockey. That was my main sport. I also tried lots of other things, like a bit of cross country, a bit of rowing, a bit of netball, but I really didn't enjoy netball. But yeah, hockey was my main thing, and that's why I played through uni. I think I was quite lucky at uni in that I was playing first team, but mainly because I just had the fitness and I could run around a lot. My skills were non-existent. So any kind of hand-eye coordination, I'm really not that good at. And that was also one of the reasons for, I guess, joining the triathlon club. That all coincided with being about a year after I'd moved to London with work. And I definitely missed having that competitive outlet with sport from, you know, being used to playing hockey like a game once or twice a week for like the last three years at uni, and then obviously all the way through school. So I was quite keen to have something else competitive.
One thing that struck me is the amount of drive and personal drive you're going to have to have done what you've done, not just with actually the events and the winning, but also the training and what you've had to do. And I know from other interviews, when you were working in London, it was a pretty big job. You were doing really long days. It was, and you've crammed all this training in around it. What is it that's driven you? Is it something that was still there when you were playing hockey, or is it something that developed over time?
I think I've always had ambition and drive, and I think the way that my parents brought us up has always been, you know, you should do things to the best of your ability, and if you're going to do something, do it properly. But I think with triathlon, it probably comes more from that competitiveness. Like, I just like winning. Probably as simple as that. Like, and like, I enjoy the training, so like, I get particularly when I was working those long hours, I found the training was a real mechanism for me to manage stress and kind of process the day and get it all out of my head. But yeah, I think I've always had it to some extent, but I think triathlon's just kind of brought it out a bit more.
The question that I would like to ask is, so you work long hours and then you do your sport and you realize, oh, actually, I could be quite good in that. I don't know if you ask how or when was it that you said, well, I want to sacrifice even more time on top of my job to try the best that I could potentially be?
So I think I probably knew that I had a chance of being reasonably good at it. I think probably when I stepped up to the half Ironman, because like I was usually winning the age group race overall, like I qualified for the world champs. And then I guess stepping up to Ironman, like my first Ironman was not very good. I had lots of tummy troubles. But after that, it then all went pretty well. So I guess like from that point, I'd started thinking about, you know, I probably do want to go professional at some point and give it a go, because I'd hate to look back and think, I wish I'd tried it. You know, obviously with sport, there's a real age limit on it, whereas with work, you can always go back to it. But I was also conscious that, you know, I still have career ambitions in that kind of more traditional workplace. And I wanted to be at a point where I was senior enough to make it really easy to kind of step away for a bit and come back in, which is basically where I got to with that last job that I was doing. I wanted to be at a point where I felt like I could step aside and be doing sort of 1 or 2 days a week, or even go on a proper sabbatical, but also be able to come back in at a reasonable level and feel like I hadn't missed too much. So I think I had all those things kind of going on around my head that kind of formed my decision of when I might turn pro or not. But I think up to that point, I was very much like, well, I want to be the best age grouper. And actually, I did, like, winning Kona overall was definitely one of the things that I wanted to do before going pro. Had I not done it last year, I probably still would have made the decision to go pro, because it would have probably felt a bit ridiculous trying to hang on for another year. And I think by that point, it's like, I'd won quite a lot of things at an age group level, so I was ready for the next challenge and being like, actually, let's just go up against the best women in the world. Like, why not? It's another challenge. See what happens.
That must be pretty cool, though. I mean, you talk about sort of going pro and doing those things. There must have been a cool moment, though, where you've gone from being an amateur and looking at the pros almost like there's them and there's us kind of thing. Mm. And then that moment when you're like, ooh, I'm one of them. I'm looking at the amateurs and I'm part of this pretty exclusive kind of club. That must have felt pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm actually very happy that I made the decision to race my first pro race really soon after Kona. So 7 weeks after, I went out to Australia and did Ironman Western Australia. And yes, there were many moments where I had that kind of moment of like, oh, I'm one of them. You know, like it's little things from, oh, you get to walk down the pro line to go and register, or you have like the pro briefing, which is a little bit different. But I think it really struck me when I was on the start line. That's probably the main thing that's really different to a normal sort of Ironman race, because usually you're all in like a big pen, there's like thousands of people and you're like fighting to try and get to the front so you can try and like run into the water first. Whereas, you know, there was like, I think it's like 15 of us, and we watched the men go off, and then, you know, we all get lined up and you're looking around and like, oh, there's all these women that I've been like following for the last few years, and they're all amazing athletes and they've all got great stories. So yeah, that felt really surreal. I was like, I'm actually on a start line with you. Because even though you're doing the same race as them in lots of other races, you don't really feel like, you know, it is a slightly different race. That was probably the kind of pinch myself moment. But yeah, I now look back and I'm like, thank God I did that. Otherwise, who knows where my first race would have been.
When you're up against people that you've been following, I'm never quite sure. Is it like a real inspiration? Because you're like, wow, I'm finally here. I'm going to do my best and raise my game. Or is it slightly intimidating when you look at them and go, but they are so good. I follow their training regime. I look at what they do. How does it feel on that start line?
So I think when you're actually in the race, it's like they're just another competitor. Like, I had that surreal moment, but then it's like race brain switches on, the gun goes, you're off. And like, I don't think you can really worry about, I think in an Ironman particularly, you can't really worry about other people because actually, you know, it's a really bloody long day. And like, if you start worrying about everyone else, then you're just going to get in your head. You're going to, you know, psych yourself out. And it's all going to be a bit ridiculous. I definitely had some moments leading up to the race where I was like, I don't really know if I'm good enough to race these ladies. You know, like, you know, you definitely have moments of self-doubt and wondering. Yeah, because again, you see, now with social media, you see what everyone is doing training-wise or supposedly doing training-wise. And I think some of the volumes, some of the numbers and stuff that people put out, that can be quite intimidating. But for me, probably one of the things that I really like about triathlon and the longer distance stuff is that, generally speaking, if you've done the training and you're really fit, you'll do quite well. It's much more about what can you do. You don't have to think so much about the tactics, etc. You just got to go and race to your best ability and hope that that kind of, you know, puts you up somewhere near the pointy end. Which in Australia, I mean, I made quite a few mistakes as well. So all the cyclists are like this one. So I've got my nice fancy Specialized shiv, and obviously all of last year, the Zwift Academy guys kind of helped a lot with doing some of the mechanics. Like before Kona, we had a mechanic. They sorted everything out. It was great. In Australia, I was using a disc wheel that I had raced on it that earlier that year, but I changed it to be tubeless. And I didn't really think about what kind of tire I should put on it. So I put on a 28 mil tire. The shiv with the hydration system on the back doesn't have clearance of that. So, and because I had only done all like my training rides without the hydration system on the back, I hadn't tested it before race day. Another rookie error, always test all your equipment before race day. So coming out of the water, and I had a really terrible swim. I don't really know what happened. It was like worse than usual for me. So I was second last out of the water. So I was already feeling a bit rubbish about things. I then go get my bike and I was like, right, about to go out. This is where I can hopefully catch up. Tried to get out of T2, went to like flying mount onto my bike and the back wheel was just jammed. So I then had to spend like a good 5 to 10 minutes trying to work out what the problem was, because this is right on the spot, because you're coming out of transition, this is obviously where the big crowds are, so then got like all these people looking at me like, who is this girl who's meant to be racing pro, who, like, you know, her back wheel is, so someone was like, there's not enough space, you're gonna have to let some air out. So let a bit of air out, kind of got going, but it was rubbing most of the bike leg. I was then kind of getting into the rhythm, and I was like, I'm sort of catching a few people up here. This is good. I then got a puncture with 30K to go. Managed to fix it. And I think, to be honest, I think it's just because it was tubeless and I'd let enough pressure out. I think it just like lost the pressure. So I managed to like pump it back up, kept going. And then it went again with 15K to go. Obviously, I'd used my canisters by that point. So I had nothing. So I had to roll the last 15K back in on a completely flat disc wheel. And this was the point of the course that was like super fast. So I lost so much time and also nearly fell off quite a few times because it was like a little bit windy coming back in. And I think most people will know if you try and ride on a really flat tire, handling is not good. But anyway, by this point, I was like, clearly the race is out the window in terms of trying to be competitive. But I was like, also, I know that my run form is quite good at the moment. So let's just try and get a marathon PB. You know, let's try and get something good out of this whole shit show of a... Sorry, I don't know if I can swear, but...
it's absolutely fine.
This whole shit show of race.
I'm sure it's not as much as you were swearing at the time.
No, honestly, I had a few meltdowns on that bike leg. Then got out, first two laps, it was a 4-lap run course. First two laps, going really well, I was running on for like really good PB pace. And then like on third lap, honestly, I don't know what happened, but like my knee basically just like gave out. And like I hadn't really had any issues with it before. And it just, I honestly thought, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to pull out. And I thought, like, oh, I cannot DNF my first pro race. Like that'd be so embarrassing. So I managed to like walk a little bit and I settled in my head. I was like, right, if I have to walk the whole next two laps, I'm just going to have to do it. Cause like either way, I'm going to finish this race. And then I was like, I'm going to try jogging, and I've tried jogging, and it kind of eased up a bit. So then I was able to like jog the rest of it, and actually came in, I was only like a minute slower than my marathon PB. So I was like, I definitely would have got a PB had I not had that issue. So that whole race, absolute disaster, but I was like, I'm really glad that I did that. So I got that first pro experience out of the way, and hopefully means that next time I will have made all those silly mistakes and I won't make those silly mistakes.
Won't ever happen again.
Well, hopefully. Do you know what? That is the thing, is everything that you take, you learn, don't you? And you do the next thing. But I can just imagine that moment of when you're stood there and you're like, there is something wrong. I'm a pro. There's a crowd. I'm just going to check everything, and now I'm going to have to check it all again. And now, oh, for f- sake, what is it that's wrong with it and all the rest of it? Oh, my goodness, I can't imagine. Oh, that must have been that moment where you... But to be fair, you did, you know, you chased people down on the bike with essentially the brake on for most of it, and then a flat tire. Well, I tell you what, if that doesn't prove the drive you've got to do that and then still get around that run, that is brilliant.
Also, it is such a much better story to tell it to us now, because if you would have just said like, oh, I just entered and won, it was easy, it would have been so boring.
Boring, really boring.
Yeah, how boring is that winning?
Really boring.
You did that and you thought straight afterwards, I'll do another one. Did you get, absolutely. And how did you get on with the next one?
Well, it got cancelled.
So it was South Africa, right?
Yeah. So I was meant to be in South Africa. And I really thought, because they'd only cancelled it really late, so I was like, oh, we might just get away with it. And I nearly flew out. So I was like, ooh. But then they literally the day before I was meant to be flying out, they then cancelled it. So probably good things. So I've had a friend who flew out for Cape Epic and was stuck out there for like an extra 4 weeks because they were on proper lockdown. So
I think they cancelled the Cape Epic the night before the race.
The night before, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bit bizarre. What? Absolutely. It must have been terrible being stuck there in that sun and beautiful weather.
And the vineyards and, awful. Worst places to be stuck, for sure. But, so South Africa was meant to be my next race.
Have you ever been to South Africa?
No, I haven't. So I was really looking forward to actually going. And I've got a friend, one of the girls from the Zwift Academy lives out there and lives kind of in Port Elizabeth. So I was going to go and stay with her, like have a good catch up. Her parents also have, I don't know what the main thing is it does, but one of their byproducts is gin. So we're obviously going to have some gin tasting after the race, which I'm gutted to miss out on. So so generally it would have been a really good trip, but we'll have to save it for next year.
Well, that actually brings me on to one of my more important and insightful questions during this lockdown period, which is, what is your favourite gin cocktail and how are you coping during lockdown? What's your go-to gin cocktail?
I don't really go for gin cocktails. I just have gin and tonic. Like, I just, I'm quite boring with it. I'm quite, I've been sampling different gins. So actually currently I've got a Chapel Down gin, which is really nice, made from the Pinot Noir grapes. I'd highly recommend it. So yeah, I'm usually just quite boring. I find a lot of the cocktails are a bit sweet. If I had to go for a cocktail, it'd probably be more like a mojito or something like rum-based. Because yeah, I like my gin, just gin and tonic. But how am I coping with the lockdown? I've been working my way through sampling British wines. I can confirm that our red wine is generally pretty shit. The white wine's very nice and the bubbles are also very good. But yeah, I found one reasonable red, but it wasn't great. Still got a few to work through though. Might find one good one.
Well, it's good you're doing this great work for the British wine industry. And if you do find any particular names, let us know. I think this is probably just a quick word to sponsors as well. If you are,
if a British vineyard would like to sponsor me, I'll happily take that.
Just amazing. That was so
absolutely
good.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think getting your water hydration system getting caught on the back wheel is a bad thing, if it was a bottle of wine, at least you'd have something to stop and enjoy on your way around.
Exactly.
And now that you're with the hiatus in the, as it were, in the racing calendar, what's your plan at the moment? Have you kind of written off the season and you're kind of reducing your training, or are you trying to maintain a level of fitness in case the season comes back and there's some more events you can do? Because it must be really tough to work out which way to go.
Yeah, I've written off the season for racing because I think I can't see us being at a point where I think any mass participation events will be allowed to go ahead by the end of the year. But if I get proved wrong, then it's a massive bonus and then I get a bonus race. So I think that's a better way to think about it. But saying that, I'm trying to keep a good level of fitness because I'm just looking at it as I've got an extra year to get faster, fitter, stronger, better at everything until I have to go and race all these girls. So I kind of, you know, it's not necessarily that much of a bad thing for me that I've got to wait longer to race. Like it sucks in that I love racing, but with these situations, you just got to look at the positives. I'm not in Spain. I'm not locked into a flat that I can't get out of, which I think I really would have gone mad by now if that was the case. Got really nice weather. So it's like, yeah, I feel reasonably positive about it all. And I'd love to have some races by the end of the year. I think like maybe there'll be some local races, but I don't think there'll be any big Ironman races. So yeah, for me, it's just, let's keep trying to make improvements and everything and be ready for next year.
Does it have any negative implications on your career as such? Because you just started your first year of being pro. I assume that you have to have a certain amount of sponsors or something, and they might have expectations on showing their names or brands.
I think, again, the way I'm looking at it, I think, yes, it has negative implications in that I can't prove myself and I can't... there's not that much that I can do for sponsors at the moment. And I guess I was hoping that I would have had a good year of racing and would then be able to get sponsors for next year in terms of, you know, I'd like to be able to get a bike sponsor, etc. And like some of the big things that I haven't got this year. So I think it's probably just going to push everything back by a year, which is a bit frustrating. But again, it just gives me another year to hopefully then be better when I can race and hopefully make a bit more of an impact. So yeah, there's definitely downsides. And I guess the other thing that I'll need to think about a little bit is I'd put aside a load of savings to make sure that there wasn't too much financial pressure on this year. And kind of thank God I did, because I would have been so. But, you know, kind of, I guess depending on when it looks like we can maybe race and try and make some money from it, from that side of things, you know, I may have to do a bit more work than I'm doing now, potentially. But yeah, so there's that to think about as well. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. It's just kind of weighing up all the different options and kind of what seems to be best.
I have to say, that is really good to hear that you're in a great place, because if you're financially secure for the next year. If you can keep yourself going through now, you can focus in on that training and just increase that speed ready for next year. That's a brilliant position to be in.
Yeah, pretty good.
Just taking it a step back, because I assume that most of our listeners are just cyclists and they don't really know much about triathlon. When we talk about turning pro or going pro, what does it actually mean? That might be a really stupid question, but I think in cycling it's relatively straightforward. In triathlon, do you have to justify it with results and then also maybe with a certain financial threshold? They say like, okay, I can justify to go to X amount of events a year. Or how does that work?
It depends which country you're in as to what limits you have to hit to turn professional. But yeah, in every country, it's basically they will set guidelines that you hit to turn professional. And the turning professional literally is a letter from your triathlon federation that says you can race at an elite level. Oh. And that is it. And then all it means is that you start with the professionals rather than age groupers. And I guess you're eligible to prize money if you do well. But yeah, the British triathlon guidelines, I think, probably some of the hardest ones to hit. So basically, you have to come within 7% of the winning professional's time, which, as you can imagine, over an Ironman doesn't actually give you a huge amount of leeway. I think it usually gives you about 30 to 40 minutes-ish, depending on how fast the course is. Or you can win Kona, is another one of their things. Or there's usually another couple of races that they also take into consideration. But then at the end of all that, it is also subjective. So they can also turn around and say yes or no. So that's kind of, it's actually quite complicated. But yeah, then racing professionally, it literally just means you start in front of the age groupers, you might be able to get some prize money. For Ironman, you then just buy one professional license as opposed to paying for each race. And a lot of the challenge brands give you free entry. But yeah, that's literally it. It's like if you hit that threshold, you write a letter to your federation saying I'd like to be professional, and they come back and say yes or no.
Ah. And then in terms of sponsors that would finance this, I guess, is it then that sponsors are waiting for you, or do you have to go to the sponsor? I really have no clue.
That would be nice, but no, there's definitely no, like, the sponsorship is the really, really tough part of it. And I think for a sport like triathlon, it's not really that mainstream, it's not really on TV. There's not, I guess, it's quite a hard sell to sponsors other than those that are kind of in triathlon. And even then, I think actually it was probably easier for me to get sponsors when I was the best age grouper than it is as being like I guess I've not really raced much, but you know, at the moment I'm not one of the top pros, so it's quite difficult to sell what I think I can offer them. But it is very much you go out, you have to approach sponsors, you have to think about what it is you can offer and how you pitch that. And I think that's why I was kind of, so for this year I'm mainly working with sponsors that I've worked with before, so I kind of already had relationships with them, like Precision Hydration and Orca. Precision Hydration I've actually been using for like the last probably 5 years. They were the first people I approached when I was starting to get reasonable, and they've been great. And I think hydration is, you know, especially at Kona, a really, really important part of it. Orca, then I used them when I was on Team Free Speed, which is the team that I was part of before Zwift Academy. And again, they're just really nice guys. They make really good kit. So I was kind of keen to work with them again. And then I was then looking around, so like from nutrition was quite a hard one for me, because we were using the science and sports stuff when I was on the Zwift Academy, which actually I did really like, but I was also quite keen to have a bit of flexibility. And I found this company, they're actually a British company, they're called KOM Fuel, that you can basically just completely personalize your nutrition, and they agreed to sponsor me, so that was quite good. So it means that like I can kind of just pick and choose what I want from any of the brands, which is great.
Do they the big question of course is, do they do wine?
They unfortunately don't do wine, but I might suggest it as important recovery tool.
Exactly, yeah.
So I guess like they're probably my three main ones. And then Zwift, actually, whilst we're not part of the academy anymore, they are still supporting us by providing a little bit of financial support, which actually is going to be even more helpful this year, given there's not much opportunity to earn anything. But again, I think you know, I've always been a big fan of Zwift. Probably, I probably don't use it as much now because I'm not doing as much early morning or like really condensed training. But the one good thing that they are now doing with coronavirus is they're putting on a weekly race series for triathletes. So last week I did the first one and, you know, I was racing against like Flora Duffy and some of the other Olympic athletes, as well as them, people like Lucy Charles. So it's like bringing together the whole range of the triathletes, which is amazing. Like, you, like, I'm never going to get that opportunity in a real race. So yeah, always been a fan of Zwift. So yeah, so I was keen this year to keep it to not too many sponsors because I didn't want too much pressure. And I was like, I'd rather work with the guys that I like and the guys that I think are going to be good longer term. And then I was hoping to get good results. So then like try and secure, you know, like a bike sponsor or something like that for next year. But just have to leave it another year, I reckon.
Yeah. And with just one other thing with the sponsors, does it take much time up in your normal racing and your normal routine to provide them with all the content they want and updates and sharing what you're up to with different sponsors? Mm. Or is it something that just fits within your current routine?
So I think, because I've kept it reasonably light touch, actually it's not been too much hassle. And I think the other good thing is because I sort of started doing my YouTube channel, actually a lot of kind of what I was doing for that, I could then sort of send to them if they wanted specific bits. So it kind of, I haven't found it too much hard work, but I can imagine that for some people who have either lots more sponsors or sponsors that are actually paying them a lot more, there probably is way higher expectation. But again, you know, it's kind of, you've got to look at it as a, if they're offering you something or paying you, then, you know, you need to give them some value back. So yeah, I've found it so far pretty like light touch and kind of just a part of day to day what I'm doing.
By the way, your YouTube channel, I really enjoy that. Every time there's a new video, we watch it straight away. It's really, really good. And also, I have to say, I think when I asked you to come on the show, this already a couple of weeks ago. Mm. And the reason it took so long is because Mike and I actually wanted to come to you to talk to you in this little cafe. Because it looks really, really
it's
cute.
Really nice,
so
isn't it?
Yeah, so you actually want to come around. And then we realized actually, okay, that won't be for some time.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, we have to do it now via Skype. Mm. But well,
I'm lucky in that I've got a great guy that's basically putting all my YouTube stuff together, and that's why it's taking longer to get the next one out. So I'm basically having to film myself, which, as you can imagine, is quite hard, and my quality of footage is terrible. And he's then trying to edit it into something that's half decent.
It's 226 photography, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, maybe if you listen to this, you should go to Instagram and follow him. It's at two, like the word, and then 26 underscore photography. It's really, really good.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, both his photos and then his video stuff. Yeah, he's awesome.
Where are you based at the moment? Because I know you're normally based in London, which is where we'd plan to, hopefully we were planning to meet you, but where are you based at the moment since lockdown?
Yeah, so when it looked like lockdown was definitely coming, I basically made the decision to get out of London in case it ended up being really strict lockdown. So I'm actually in Yorkshire at the moment, which has been great. You know, like the cycling around here is obviously amazing, as is the running. And yeah, I think just being out of London at this point is quite good. I think I probably wasn't that worried about the risk of infection. It was more the thought of being trapped in a house in London if they made it more like Spain style lockdown or something like that. So yeah, I made the decision to get out, and it's definitely been the right decision. I think it's been nice to be out in the country.
Absolutely. We've been quite lucky with the weather. For those that are listening to this podcast way into the future and the time of coronavirus lockdown is just a far distant memory, it seems like it always rains in the UK. And then suddenly during lockdown, the sun has come out. The rain has
been
gone.
Amazing.
It has. And the cars have left the road. It has actually been, if you're a cyclist, let's not talk about it too loudly. It's actually
perfect.
Been quite good.
It's been really good. I really, really hope that when lockdown is lifted, there's like, I don't know, something either people change their habits a bit to not have as many cars on the road, etc. Because yeah, cycling at the moment, other than the few random people that have given me loads of abuse, has been really, really nice.
Is anyone chopping something on the chopping board?
Oh, yeah. Let me move.
Yeah. So it's all this nice weather. I mean, riding outdoors and running outdoors, I can completely relate to that. But there's obviously also swimming. So what are you doing with swimming in this time of lockdown?
I'm actually very lucky in that where I'm staying, there's an endless pool. So I'm one of the few people that can still swim. But don't tell anyone, because it's going to be my excuse for when I start racing again.
No, we won't tell anyone.
And I'm still shit at swimming. I'm going to blame lockdown. So I was like, maybe, just maybe, I might be able to like improve my swimming marginally whilst everyone else can't swim for like 2 months.
You are staying in the most fantastic places. You've moved around slightly. We've got to see in the background this fabulous location that you're in, with an endless pool, long winding roads, and great places to run as well.
Beautiful.
It's trapped on heaven.
filled with English wine and gin.
And gin. We're running low on chocolate, though. That's the only issue.
You know, I'm so jealous. Now, I think it's worth us now venturing into some questions that we had sent in earlier on today, knowing that you were coming on. We did put a few feelers out to try and get some really insightful questions from the Velocino Massive, let's call them, the Velocino group. We were thinking within there's actually some pretty good athletes, and some of them have done all sorts of different types of triathlon and cycling in particular, and we thought we'd get some really interesting, insightful questions. Niels, do you want to ask some of the questions that we got from our friends?
Yeah, let me just find them.
Niels is now desperately trying to make up a really intelligent question before we get there.
Has it made you realise that triathletes are generally a really geeky, boring lot?
Is pretty much one of the questions. No. Yeah.
So, okay, one of the questions was, do you think that the new Nike Vaporfly shoe will have a place in Ironman Marathon? This is the shoe with the carbon spring that Eliud Kipchoge was using for his marathon record?
I mean, yeah, I run in them. They are faster, for sure. Yeah, if Nike wants to sponsor me, which they definitely won't.
Mr. Nike, if you listen to that, you should definitely do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how well proven it is over marathon distance, but I have definitely seen over the half marathon, I found it faster. Difficult to say by quite how much, but like, I think for most people, they are the fastest shoe that you can run in. I think whether or not they have a future depends on how quickly everyone else catches up. So now they've got, to be fair, for the other brands, they've now got longer to try and develop their shoes that are the same. So maybe by next year, there'll be lots of options.
That's really out of interest with those shoes, because I know nothing about how great they are. I can see where the spring is going to take you travel forward quicker. Does it allow any more, what's the word I'm looking for? Cushioning for your knee or anything like that? Because I'm thinking over the longer distances, does it give any sort of benefit for long distance training or anything?
Yeah, so actually I think they originally developed it because they developed it more as a training shoe, because it is slightly more cushioned, and actually the way that it pushes you quite far forward, so it makes you run more like on your toes, and I think it makes you have less time on the ground, which I think results in there being less impact. And there'll be someone listening to this who'll be like, nah, she's talking opposite bollocks. But
hey, look, just say it with confidence and we will all believe you.
Definitely. So I think it was initially developed to be the kind of the training shoe so that he could run more miles. But I think the only thing that both I've found and that I know other people have found is because it has got quite a big platform, it's quite hard to corner. You know, as much as you kind of corner in running, but because you're like quite high up and because of the way it like tilts you forward, it's quite easy to like roll over. So I think there's been quite a few like rolled ankles from them. But so
like dancing in high heels, basically.
Yeah, a little bit. But generally speaking, like it's a really fast shoe. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you described it as dancing in high heels so that Niels could understand and empathise.
It was actually him that came up with that. That's not even me. He clearly does it all the time.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I wore high heels.
Oh, back in the day. So it's just like it's a long time gone.
Yeah.
Like since I'm married, I'm not. Anyways.
You're not allowed to do that anymore.
Exactly. To be frank, that was the only really geeky question when I read it. I was like, what the hell? Anyways, so the next one, and I think you might be able to relate to that very well because you were age grouper before and now you turn pro. What, in your opinion, is the biggest and easiest rectifying mistake that you see age group racers make in either racing or training?
I mean, I think it's got to be training more than racing. And I think it's got to be that people try and do too much. And I think, again, it's really easy. Like, you look at what you think everyone else is doing, or, you know, I think in particular, I probably know a few people that don't have coaches that just think they can add volume upon volume upon volume. Whereas actually, if you look at, and I think, you know, if you look at some of the pros, for example, a lot of the ones that did really well in Kona last year were ones that were actually injured for a big chunk of the year. So actually couldn't really train that much. And I think, I think it's not even just an age group problem. I think pros have the same issue that you just think, especially for Ironman, you need to train more and do more volume. When in actual fact, I think a lot of people benefit from taking a bit more of a break and not being that tired, particularly when you're then trying to juggle work, family, other life pressures. I think don't be worried that more equals better, because actually a lot of the time it really doesn't. Just be a bit more specific and focused in your training.
That's really good.
I've got another question from our group, which is, will you be getting an Ironman tattoo? Or will you not bother, and why not?
I won't be, because I think it's the equivalent of getting like a McDonald's sign on you, like it is a brand.
Nothing wrong with it.
Why? Do you have one of those?
Of course, no.
I won't be. Also, like, I've already got my one dodgy tattoo from when I was an 18-year-old, so I don't need another one.
There's now the next question is obviously,
what is it?
What is your dodgy tattoo?
It's like a Pegasus with a horn.
And why did you get a unicorn on your
I got it because we were in the tattoo shop and I wanted a tattoo, and that was the one that I thought looked the best at that time in my probably slightly still drunk state.
I think that's the way we all got our first tattoo, isn't it? Let's face it.
Mike, do you have a tattoo?
Me?
Yeah.
Yes.
I never saw
How
that.
Did you not know that he's got that?
I've never seen that one. So for the audience, it's basically like, you might remember, like Pamela Anderson, she had like a barbed wire across her upper arm.
It's just like that, yeah, but much bigger.
Almost, yeah.
I was a big fan of Baywatch, and I thought, what better way to show my allegiance than getting a Pamela Anderson tattoo around my arm?
Yeah, definitely better than my pineapple tattoo on my ribcage. Anyways, let's crack on.
For those of you that are listening to this part of the podcast and thinking how few questions that we had, this is because we had to edit most of them out because of quite how bad they were. Right, one of them we have got. Serious question. What is the best comfort break strategy for Ironman? Hold it in or let it out? This sparked a slight debate in the group, with some people suggesting that your best bet is to stop and get back on because it's not worth the suffering.
But it depends if it's the one or number one.
I was going to say, it depends on what kind of comfort break.
It then descends into these sorts of comments, which I'm going to ignore.
Yeah. So, I mean, for number one, you just go. And if it's number two, then... Well, any of the races that I've not had tummy trouble in, I've not needed one. So, and the race that I did need it, which was Lanzarote, was generally just horrendous. And I was just running, sort of waddling / walking from Portaloo to Portaloo for the whole marathon. So, not ideal. So, yeah, definitely. But generally speaking, hopefully you don't need a number two. And if it's a number one, you just go. But try make sure there's no draft busters around you because you're not actually allowed to do it on the bike.
Are you not?
No. Ah. But everyone does. I say everyone. The vast majority of people do.
I have this image in my head that says like water splashing around everywhere.
Well, it's also, it's a very good incentive if someone's drafting you to get them off your back wheel.
So. I will try that in our next group ride.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, you're on your own, mate. We do have a somebody else who is associated with the podcast, sort of distantly, once wore a mankini, and we always said that was a great way to stop anybody trying to draft you.
Yeah.
So one of the questions is, why do you spoil bike ride by combining it with swimming and running? I think that's the standard question for cyclists to triathletes.
Why? Why is it actually? I wonder. Every now and then you get from cyclists that there's like a certain, I hope I'm not tipping on anyone's toes now of our listeners or so, but I always have a feel there's a bit of a, almost cyclists are looking down to triathletes.
Like any group of sporty people, I think you get quite cliquey and you think your sport is the best. So I imagine there's probably a lot of triathletes that look down on cyclists. And I don't know, like, I think for me, like, cycling is my favorite part. So if I was going to choose one, it would be cycling. But there's something about trying to combine all three, just like more of a challenge. And yeah, it's good.
Cool. Yeah, I must admit, as a, although I don't do triathlon myself, having watched it, I love the fact that it's almost impossible to be equal in all three. So you've got to also bide your time. Do you push on your weakest event, you know, make the most of a weakness, close the gap, or do you make the most of a strength? Particularly cyclists coming in to triathlon, you see the pace that they can stick on the ride, but then can they make it stick on the run? And it's, I think it's a brilliant thing to watch while sat with a beer in my hand, my feet up on the sofa.
Yeah. I reckon so.
Ruth, thank you so much for being on our podcast. It's been lovely to meet you, and it's been great to get some insights into the world of pro athlete, as well as the transition into that, as well as what happens, obviously, when you're training for triathlon. It's also been great to get some top tips on British wine and the best gin for us to be selecting. So it's been great all round. So thank you very much. If people want to follow you, where's the best place to keep up with what you're up to?
You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter. I'm at Rastle50. That's RASTLE50. Or I've also got my YouTube channel, so you can see more of what I get up to and laugh at some of my not being very good at being filmed.
They're really, really good.
So they'd be the main places to follow me for sure. But yeah, thanks very much for the chat. It's been great to chat to you guys.
Well, Nils, if people want to get in touch with the show, how do they do that?
Well, in the last episode, actually, you took the mickey out of me on how I pronounce everything. So I just keep it short and snappy. Just send us an email to hello. No, just send us an email to.
Is this why you sit at me?
I thought short and snappy was your nickname you'd given me. Sorry, mate. I'm with you. Carry on.
Just send us an email to podcast@villocino.com. Follow us on Twitter on @villocinopdcst or on Instagram on @justvillocino with a double C. Boom.
Excellent. Very short, very snappy. Excellent. And if anybody would like to support the podcast, please give us a review on iTunes, or more importantly, head over to the Villocino shop and pick up yourself a pair of socks. Great. Well, look, Ruth, thank you once again for your time. Enjoy your evening supper and enjoy your training. And we can't wait to see you next year at the top of the podium.